Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Cheltimer, my co-host, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, Erica Rummel. Well, Erica, they always say truth is greater than fiction, and judging by those letters, I think that's right. So I'm not surprised you were inspired to go and write a novel based on this as well. But how closely does your novel Three Women and Alfred Nobel follow history?
Well, of the three protagonists, the three women in the novel, two are historical figures, Sophie Hess, Nobel's mistress, and the pacifist Bertha von Suttner, called Bertha in my novel. I've kept fairly close to the evidence, except in the case of Nicolaus Kapi, the man Sophie married eventually. We know very little about him, and so I've taken liberties with his character and filled in the gaps. The third protagonist, Ida, is my own invention. In the novel, she has lost her fiancé in an explosion in one of Nobel's dynamite factories, and she is determined to take revenge on Nobel, whom she holds responsible for the accident, and to reveal his unscrupulous business practices and his profiteering. At the beginning of the novel, Ida is rather self-righteous, but let me say, without giving away too much, that she soon runs into a situation that takes her down a notch. She falls in love with Sophie's husband.
Oh dear.
And discovers, therefore, that she, like Nobel, is human and subject to temptations and liable to go wrong.
Well, she sounds like an interesting character. Were the real life characters of Sophie and Bertie as interesting? Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Certainly, Sophie's life was interesting, as I said in a few words in my reading. As far as Bertha von Suttner is concerned, she was briefly Nobel's secretary, then married a Viennese count, and wrote a bestseller promoting peace.
Oh.
Together with her husband, she organized international peace conferences and raised funds for the cause of pacifism. And it was Bertha von Suttner, who inspired Nobel to set up the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh.
And she was a recipient in 1905, the first woman to receive the Peace Prize. I do feel obliged to respect the historical sources, but that said, I also feel it's my right as a novelist to guess at what the sources don't tell us, and to express the thoughts of the historical characters and to put words into their mouth. In other words, to make them come alive for my readers.
Right. Yeah. And somehow, too, doing that makes history live on rather than just a list of facts, doesn't it?
Yes, but mm-hmm. In this particular case, the nonfiction is dramatic enough,
yeah.
But in many cases, a novel can make it more exciting and can engage readers more than a history book.
Right. So how did your imaginary character, Ida, become the third character in this? How does she fit in?
Well, as we have heard, Sophie's story is dramatic enough in itself, but at the same time, it's a little too predictable for the kind of psychological novel I had in mind. Her affair with Nobel is a simple story. Older man is attracted to sexy young woman, discovers that they're incompatible, or perhaps gets tired of her, and gradually backs out of the relationship. Now, Bertie, the other historical character, presents us with a different storyline. Nobel treats her with respect and as an intellectual equal. So now we have two contradictory images. Nobel, the domineering male chauvinist, on the one hand, and Nobel, the generous and enlightened philanthropist, on the other. So I introduced the character of Ida and gave her the job of finding out the truth about Nobel, truth in quotation marks, right? In her search, she learns of events in Nobel's life that soften her attitude toward him and put his actions in perspective. But more importantly, she finds out a great deal about herself in mm-hmm. the process. Falling in love with Sophie's husband, she faces a moral dilemma. And so the question is, how will she handle this dilemma? Can she hang on to her man and to her integrity? Well, of course, I keep my readers guessing to the very end to find out whether there can be a happy ending for Ida.
You've used Vienna as the background for several of your novels. You've used it for the painting on Auersberg Wall and the effects of isolation on the brain, for instance. Do you choose Vienna again because of the plot or because of because the settings become a character in the story for you?
Well, I'd say both. The novels you mentioned deal with historical events that took place in Vienna, so that the city itself plays a role in the unfolding of the story. But as they say, and rightly so, as an author, you should write about what you know. And I do know Vienna. I was born there and emigrated to Canada as a young adult at the age of 22, so that the descriptions are based on my own impressions and on my own experience of the city.
Have you returned in that time?
Yeah, I used to go back to Vienna more frequently when I still had family, but now that's no longer the case. I haven't been back in a number of years.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could read to us again from the novel this time, Three Women and Alfred Nobel.
Okay, so the first protagonist we meet is Ida, the one that I made up. The dream begins with a bright flash, an explosion that tightens my heart and triggers a panic. The moan of a dying man fills my ears. I see him stretched out on the cratered earth, his mouth blackened as if he had swallowed soot. I see a woman standing by a stove stirring a dish with a wooden spoon. The force of the explosion throws her against the wall and crushes her head. Her body slackens as she slides down to the floor. Her eye sockets are filled with blood. Blood runs from the cavity that was her nose and from her gaping mouth. A man's voice comes through the shattered window, saying something about the tragedy that could have been avoided. His voice grows louder and turns into a roar. He's screaming at me. No, I am screaming. I wake up with a jolt, sink back onto my pillow, and stare up at the ceiling until the bloody images in my head dissolve, until my breathing returns to normal, and I realize where I am, safe in my bedroom in a quiet suburb of Vienna. It's years since the accident, years since Georg's death, but the nightmares keep exploding in my head. Even now that I'm awake, I can't stop the chain of memories. I'm back with Georg. It's the day of his departure for Heleneborg, a factory town in Sweden. We are on our way to the railway station, walking on a path between overhanging trees. The gravel crunches under our feet. Georg sets down his suitcase and puts his arms around me. He's so tall he has to lean down to kiss me. I press my body against his. I want to remember every curve, every tendon and muscle. I pass my hands over his neck and face to memorize their contours, the texture of his skin. Even now I tremble with the memory of his body, that last embrace. His words come back to me. It will be years before we can get married, Ida. Will you wait for me? I'll wait, but you'll come home for Christmas, Georg, won't you? If I can manage it. But they never see each other again. By Christmas, Georg is dead, killed in an accident at Nobel's factory. And now we meet Sophie. The cab draws up in front of the hotel. It has a solid look, Sophie thinks. It tells the world that she's no longer an outsider, no longer living in the shadows. In a few weeks, she will be a married woman and on the guest list of respectable hostesses, she hopes. True, the hotel no longer attracts the crème de la crème. But that's the fault of the management. They haven't kept up with the times. Why don't they install electric lights and ensuite bathrooms in every apartment? That's what the better sort of people expect nowadays. Then again, if the hotel had all the modern conveniences, she couldn't afford to rent an apartment there. Alfred isn't as generous as he used to be. Maybe she shouldn't have written that letter. "What you have done is a sin," she wrote. "I wasted my youth on you and have to be grateful that Nicolas Capi has agreed to marry me. No one wants a wife who has been another man's mistress for so many years." No, she was right to speak out. Every word in that letter was true. Why didn't he do the right thing years ago and make an honest woman of her? "We aren't suited to each other," he said. Well, that's not what he said when they first met. She remembers the passionate letters he wrote when they were apart, even for a day. And when she gave him the tiniest hint that she was unhappy, he was full of sympathy. But then he changed his tune. When she was unhappy and complained of boredom, he lectured her in that pompous style of his. You are bored because you have nothing to do. You don't work, you don't write, you don't read, you don't even think. But he was wrong. She was thinking all the time. She couldn't stop thinking about her precarious situation. Her reputation was ruined and she had no means of supporting herself. What if he deserted her? He was no longer in love with her. And over the years, he turned from a sweet old man into a grouch, forever criticizing and lecturing her. And all the nasty things he said when he was in a bad mood. That she was a greedy little Jew, true to type, just like all the Jews. Of course, when he was in a good mood, he made up for those tirades, took her out to the fashionable shops and bought her anything she wanted, dresses, shoes, jewelry. Life with Alfred was hard at times, but being separated from him was even harder. And the third woman, Bertie, who was a governess in the household of Count Suttner at the time. The Suttner girls, who ranged in age from 15 to 19, were curiously alike in temperament, as if they had been tuned by the same fork. All three were meek and had a tendency to whisper and lower their eyes. There was also a son, Arthur. He was 23, handsome, with a cheerful disposition, and very charming. Of course I fell in love with him. He was irresistible, a magnetic force. When he entered the drawing room, the atmosphere grew bright and warm. Smiles appeared on everyone's face, and conversations became animated. We all loved Arthur. One thing led to another, and he asked me to marry him. I knew his parents wouldn't welcome me into the family and wasn't surprised when his mother took me aside and with great delicacy but icy coldness gave me to understand that my position in the house was untenable and I must leave. I had expected nothing else. I resigned my position and looked for other employment. Scanning the newspapers, I came across an advertisement. A gentleman living in Paris desires to find a lady of mature years with a knowledge of German and French as secretary and manager of his household affairs. Secretarial positions were usually reserved for gentlemen, and the wording of the notice was odd. It read almost like a matrimonial advertisement. I hesitated, but I had no other prospects, and so I applied. The gentleman, Mr. Alfred Nobel, invited me to come to Paris for a trial period. The tone of his letter was stern rather than romantic, as I had feared from the style of his advertisement. He seemed to be an unhappy man, not to say a misanthrope, and I wondered what I was getting myself into. But it was the only offer I received, and poverty forced me to accept it. So these are the three protagonists referred to in the title of my novel, Three Women and Alfred Nobel. Subtitled, The Man Who Was Loved, Hated, and Perhaps Misunderstood.
Well, lots of intrigue there. Thanks, Erica. We've been talking with historian and novelist Erica Rummel. So, Erica, where can listeners buy your books?
They can go on Amazon and buy it there, or could patronize local bookstores and perhaps go to Let's Talk Books or to Lighthouse. If they aren't available there, they can perhaps put in an order for it.
Great. And listeners, if you'd like to connect with us here at the program to give us your comments or queries or suggestions, please go to our website, wordonthehills.com, and leave your message there. If you've missed a program or would like to listen to one again, you'll find all our broadcasts archived at the website too. You can listen to them anytime and from anywhere. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again for another program next week, right here on Word on the Hills, Sunday at 1 p.m. on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.